Okay, so today what I want to do is to talk about two topics, still building background for formal introduction of our MLR adaptation technique. I want to finish this example on simple regression and show you that the mean squared error solution that we arrived at is also the maximum likelihood solution under particular constraints. And then I want to explore the bias and variance of that estimate and show you some properties of that. That should take us through, I think, about two-thirds of the class. Then what I wanted to do is to spend a little bit of time reviewing some material on hidden Markov models, because the most popular form of the MLLR adaptation approach is cast in terms of hidden Markov models, and it's really hard to separate the two. Not impossible, and I'll talk about that next class, but it's really, these two kind of go together nicely, because one of the reasons MLLR has been so successful is it fits very nicely within a hidden Markov model framework. So since not everyone in the class has a formal background in hidden Markov models, I thought we probably need to spend a little bit of time just reviewing what they are. We'll draw from the pattern recognition notes. So if you want to know more about hidden Markov models, you can consult the pattern recognition notes. And I have a link here to that, and so that you can build some background in that area. So simple. Let's continue with our example of simple linear regression. Last time we postulated a linear function, a linear dependency between these variables x and y. We had that y was equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 times x, and we showed that the mean squared error solution for beta 0 was in terms of the average value of y minus beta 1 times the average value of x. And beta 1 in turn can be estimated as the expectation of x times y minus the product of the average of y and the average of x divided by this term, which is the expectation of x squared minus the expectation of x squared. And just so we're clear on the notation here, since I had a little bit of trouble in Microsoft Word Office or in PowerPoint doing the notation, the equation editor has a little bit of a problem. This first term is the expectation of x squared. The second term is the expectation of x quantity squared. They're two different terms. But this was the best I could do with the equation editor. So now what we want to do is we want to revisit this or recast this formulation in terms of random variables and compute beta 0 and beta 1 using a maximum likelihood approach. So what we will do for that is we will reformulate this problem using a probabilistic model in which the response variable y is a function of random variable x and some measurement noise. So we'll write that y is equal to some function of x plus epsilon. And epsilon is going to be our noise, and that's assumed to be independent of x and zero mean. So we essentially have a function of a random variable plus some measurement noise. Now the average value of y can be computed from this, and not surprisingly will be shown to be equal to f of x. But we're going to do this under the assumption that the x's are fixed. That's sort of the way this derivation works. And the reason for that is that x's are known. X's are our independent variables. And therefore, when we compute the expectation of y, the only real random component here is going to be epsilon, the noise. So if we take the expectation of y given x, this is going to be equal to the expectation of f of x plus epsilon given x. Now we're assuming that the x's are fixed. So this expectation of the sum of these two quantities is essentially just the f of x, since x is fixed, when you take the expectation over a fixed value, you just get that value, plus the expectation of epsilon given x. Now we said that we're going to assume that the measurement noise is independent of x, and therefore the expectation of epsilon given x is just equal to the expectation of epsilon. Conditioning epsilon on x adds no additional information, so that this expectation of y given x is just f of x plus the expectation of epsilon. And since we also said that the noise is going to be zero mean, we can then just write that the expectation of epsilon is equal to zero, and therefore, expectation of y given x is just f of x. You've actually seen this derivation in your random processes course when you dealt with functions of random variables. So this function f of x is referred to as a regression function. And formally, it's just defined as the expectation of y given the x takes on a particular value, which we call small x. Now, what we want to do next is make an assumption about this regression function. We're going to assume this regression function is of the form of a line, which can be described by beta 0 plus beta 1 times x plus epsilon. And now, the only real difference between this and our mean squared error formulation, with our mean squared error formulation, we didn't have this probabilistic component of the measurement noise. But you can sort of see where this is going. If we try to minimize the error, this measurement noise is essentially the same thing as the error term that we tried to minimize in the mean squared error. But to invoke maximum likelihood solutions, most of the time we assume that the random variables have obey Gaussian distributions. Why? Why is that particularly convenient for a maximum likelihood solution? And my pattern recognition students, of course, should know this. But we'll let someone else in the class answer this today. What?
Exponential function.
Okay, but there's an important additional step that makes that convenient. You're right that one of the reasons we like the Gaussian model is that the Gaussian model is essentially the exponential of an argument, and what's in that argument when we talk about a Gaussian distribution. Let me jump ahead to the next slide just to show you. So we have Gaussian distributions are of this form, e to the minus, and then we have some term here, right? What's sort of special about this term that makes this Gaussian model so convenient for things like maximum likelihood estimation? So there's two reasons why the Gaussian functional model is really useful for maximum likelihood, or most derivations of this form in general.
Median variance. They're characterized by median variance.
No, that's a good point, but that's not why this works. What I'm looking for is more to do with the functional form of this argument. That's useful. It's just, but let's look inside the summation. What kind of a relationship do we have here?
Arrow.
Which is a quadratic, right? And when we're going to our approach for maximum likelihood is going to be to optimize the likelihood function, which means at some point we're going to have to differentiate it. Well, when we differentiate e to the x, we get e to the x times the derivative of the argument. When we take the derivative of the argument, the fact that we have a quadratic here means its derivative is going to be we have a function of x squared, and we take the derivative, we get 2x. And why is that? So why is that useful? So we're going to have e to the x times 2x equal to 0, or some constant. Well, why is it useful that the derivative of this term give us a function that's linear in x? Well, then we end up with a set of linear equations. So one reason that the Gaussian model is useful is that we have this quadratic argument whose derivative is going to be linear in x, and that's going to give us essentially a set of linear equations. And not surprisingly, it was mentioned that this is a quadratic, this is an air energy. Not surprisingly, we'll see, because this is essentially an energy term, the maximum likelihood solution and the mean squared error solution are essentially the same. But there's one other reason why Gaussians are so useful, which I don't formally state here. When we do maximum likelihood solutions, we don't typically maximize the likelihood. We maximize some function of the likelihood. And what's that? What function is that?
Log.
The what?
The
log. Log, right. And why do we do that? The log is a monotonically increasing function, like the likelihood itself. So the optimum point we would arrive at by maximizing the function is the same optimum point we would arrive at by maximizing the logarithm of the function. But we use the logarithm because that allows this exponential term then to just become e to the x just becomes x. And then on top of those things, there's also the convenient consideration that the Gaussian distribution only has two parameters, mean and variance, so it's convenient to use this kind of a model because that minimizes the number of parameters that we have to estimate in the process. And we'll see that by introducing this assumption about Gaussian, the number of variables we have to estimate increases, because not only do we have beta 0 and beta 1, but we also have to estimate the standard deviation or the variance of the noise as part of the maximum likelihood process. So the way we're going to do this is we're going to, so now what we need to do is we need to construct a likelihood function. Now that's a little bit subtle. What we're going to do is essentially try to maximize the likelihood of all of the data given the model. So we're going to treat the data as a sequence of random pairs of x and y, and we're going to treat each one of these x's and y's as a random variable, and we're going to then try to write a likelihood function which expresses the joint probability of these x's, and we'll have n of them, and we're going to try to maximize that that likelihood jointly. So we're going to rewrite our function y sub I is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 x sub I plus epsilon sub I. This is just a way of noting that we're going to have n random pairs. That's our joint process. And we're going to try to maximize the likelihood of that joint process. So the epsilon sub i's are all going to be treated as identically independent and identically distributed. That means epsilon 1 is uncorrelated with epsilon 2 and so forth. And each of these will be drawn from a Gaussian distribution with the same mean 0 and the same variance sigma. Now we would not have to make those assumptions. We could encounter a problem space where that was not a good assumption, particularly if our problem space had some kind of temporal component to it and these epsilons were temporally related. So this may seem like a very obvious or very trivial kind of assumption, but if we think about what this really means, this means there's an assumption that the data points collected as a if these data points are collected, for example, as a function of time, x1, y1 was collected yesterday, x2, y2 was collected today, x3, y3 was collected tomorrow. Well, in that kind of a scenario, it may not be the case that each one of these variables has the same statistics. This is an assumption that's fundamental to a number of probabilistic models that we apply, and it's a good assumption for some problems, and it's not such a good assumption for other problems. A good example of a problem where this may not be a good assumption is one of our favorite examples, the stock market. If you're trying to model, for example, the Dow Jones Index, that has traditionally grown over time. If you look at the Dow Jones Index 10 years ago, it hovered, I don't know, around 5,000 or something. Then it went up to 10,000, then it went up to 15,000. So the model for that system is changing over time, and therefore it might not be a good assumption that these random pairs are essentially share the same statistics. But for time series analysis, where these points are generally very close in time, we often like to assume that over that time interval, the system is stationary, and therefore we'll just assume that these are, even though these are different noise processes, they all follow the same statistics, mu and sigma, and zero mean and variance sigma squared. So there's only three unknown parameters that we have to estimate, beta 0, beta 1, and sigma. But again, notice that by introducing the Gaussian model, we've introduced actually two additional parameters, the mean and the variance, and the mean we're assuming to be 0. If the mean is not 0, we can often pre-process the data to make the mean look like it's 0, but we still have to worry about the variance sigma. So for a fixed value of x, we can write that the distribution of y sub I is given by a Gaussian distribution. And this is another nice property of Gaussians, that if we have this function of a random variable and the input variable obeys Gaussian distribution, then we can say that the output variable y is going to obey a Gaussian distribution, but its mean is going to be f of x, whatever, and its variance is going to be sigma squared. So the variance will be the same, but the mean is going to be scaled by whatever scaling this function f of x does. So we can write the function of y as 1 over, in our Gaussian model, as 1 over the square root of 2 pi times sigma e to the minus, and then we're going to have y minus f of x sub I. This is essentially the actual value of y minus the predicted value of y divided by 2 sigma squared. So we have a model for an individual pair x and y, and now, as I said earlier, we're going to want to maximize the joint likelihood of this sequence. So we're going to write this sequence as a joint random variable, f of y1, y2, and so forth through yn. Now, that's a problem, because to estimate this function, we would actually need a joint probability distribution for all these random variables. And if, in fact, these random variables were not considered independent of one another, they were not considered drawn independently of one another, this joint estimation of this of the joint density function between these random variables would be a real problem. Because it would be essentially a Gaussian. It might be, for example, a joint Gaussian with, and that would require us to know means and correlations between these variables. However, we're going to assume that these are independent. Again, that's a very common assumption in maximum likelihood type analysis. So we can write the joint likelihood as the product of the individual likelihoods. Now, the product of these Gaussians, fortunately, is very simple. It's just going to be this constant term, 1 over 2 pi sigma, 1 over the square root of 2 pi sigma, raised to the nth power. If I just multiply n of these together. And then we're going to have the exponential terms multiplied together, which is just going to give us a sum of the arguments. So we can actually write a nice compact expression for this joint likelihood as e to the minus 1 over 2 sigma squared times the sum of the y's minus f of x's. And we have I of these, so we have a product from I equals 0 to n, which turns out to be the sum of the arguments of the exponential. And then we're going, so now we have an expression for the likelihood of the measurements y1 through yn. It's a joint likelihood. And again, there's, even though this may seem obvious, there's some important subtleties here. Why do we maximize the joint likelihood versus maximizing the likelihood? We could try to maximize the likelihood of any given measurement, just the one y. But we want to maximize the joint because we don't want to get into a situation where we maximize one but don't maximize the other. So you can imagine a solution where we produce, for example, a maximum for y2, but that's not necessarily a maximum for y3. So we don't get an overall maximum likelihood. We just get one or two of the terms individually maximized. So we put them all together to make sure that what we're ultimately going to do by choosing beta 0 and beta 1 is to maximize the likelihood of all of the data given the model, not just some subset of the data. So we can now take this expression for the joint likelihood and we can replace for our y minus f of x, we can replace that with our function beta 0 plus beta 1 x sub I. So we have y sub I minus beta 0 minus beta 1 x sub I. So this is now looking promising because we have an expression for the joint likelihood in terms of our parameters beta 0, beta 1, and sigma. The earlier in the course we talked about linear prediction. And we talked about how you could also view the linear prediction model as a maximum likelihood solution under certain assumptions. And the derivation for the linear prediction model is exactly the same kind of thing. You ultimately assume that the prediction model, you follow the same kind of a derivation where you assume that the likelihood of all of the estimates in terms of the prediction model, and you actually end up with a set of equations which is very similar, except here you're going to have the linear prediction polynomial. Now, so this is the likelihood, and now we have some choices. We could choose to maximize the joint likelihood. We could choose to maximize, and you can think of that as sort of an L2 type norm. We could choose to maximize the individual likelihood of any one data point. That would be something like an L1 norm. We could choose to maximize the minimum likelihood. That would be like an L infinity norm. But the obvious thing to do here is to maximize the likelihood this joint likelihood given these values. And to do that, we essentially want to differentiate this function with respect to the parameters and then solve the resulting set of equations. Now, fortunately, when we look at minimization of this function, or I'm sorry, maximization of this function with respect to beta 0 and beta 1, beta 0 and beta 1 only appear in the argument. So, and this is a monotonically increasing function. So, to maximize this overall function, that will be achieved if we maximize the argument of the exponential. And maximizing the argument of the exponential for beta 0 and beta 1 essentially amounts to maximizing the value of this term. I'm minimizing. We want to maximize the likelihood. We have e to the minus x, so we want to minimize, we want the argument to be as small as possible so that the e to the minus, that argument is as large as possible. So we want to minimize this summation. Well, fortunately, and not so surprisingly, that's essentially the same problem we've already solved. That makes it a minimum mean squared error problem, because this is also the form of the mean squared error that we wrote last class. So the solution to this problem is the same as our previous mean squared error solution. The maximum likelihood estimates of beta 0 and beta 1, which we'll denote with the additional symbol, this hat caret or hat sign over these arguments, over those variables, is just going to be our mean squared error solution. Average value of y minus beta 1 hat times x, and beta 1 hat is given by the cross correlation minus the product of the means divided by this variance of x minus the mean squared. And you'll notice that if the data x is zero mean, this expression actually simplifies to the cross correlation divided by the variance of x. And that's a quantity that you know, you should know from statistics as what? You may have seen that kind of a quantity before. We refer to that as what? If you have two random variables, x and y, and you compute the cross correlation of x and y divided by the variance of x, or divided by the variance of x, the square root of the variance of x times the square root of the variance of y. That's a correlation coefficient. So that's another interesting thing about linear regression. The solution essentially to the slope of the line, which is what beta 1 is nothing more than a correlation coefficient. So the and once we've got this solution for beta 0 and beta 1, the MLE estimate, the ML estimate of sigma, is also found by minimizing this argument and the way that's achieved is to use the minimum optimal values of beta 0 and beta 1. So once we do that, then we can write an expression for the variance. That reminds me of when I was in college, and at my university, we were one of the first ones to do these distance learning over television networks. But every now and then, they'd get the TV signals crossed, and you'd get broadcast television coming in over the audio track. Was it because the signal was being broadcast over the broadcast television range, some UHF channels. The maximum likelihood estimate for the Okay, I'll continue. I'll assume that's not going to make it into the audio track. If not, we've got the recording from class. So the maximum likelihood estimate of the variance is just going to be the variance we would compute using the optimal values of beta 0 and beta 1. So here we can write that as 1 over n times the sum of the y minus beta 0, beta 1 times x. So, that should actually be beta. There should be a minus sign here. So the ML estimate of the variance is a direct consequence of the ML estimates for beta 0 and beta 1, which is not surprising. So the process is to compute beta 0, compute beta 1, then we can compute sigma from those. And this is just essentially sigma is essentially just computing the variance of the error in your model. So you have the y's, you have the x's, you compute beta 0, beta 1, then you can go ahead and compute sigma. Now, so we now have the maximum likelihood estimates for the parameters of the model, but what's the next question that we want to ask about these maximum likelihood estimates? We'd like to know something about the properties of these estimates, and what's perhaps the two most important things we want to know about the properties of these estimates. And this was something I tried to get you to talk about on the exam on that third problem, but it kind of, a number of people didn't quite catch that. So, you know, as a graduate student, you come to me and you say, here, I've derived these new equations, maximum likelihood estimates of these parameters. What's the first thing I'm going to ask you? Well, what I would probably ask you is, okay, so did you get better performance on your speech recognition experiment? But what's the first thing a statistician would ask you when you derive these new equations?
Bias.
Why? What is bias? We've talked about that a few times this semester now, but I want to make sure people are clear on that. What is the bias of the estimate?
The ones between the expectation of estimation and the true expectations.
Right. And we don't often in real applications know the true value of the parameter, but we can construct experiments where we know the statistics of the signal, so therefore we know the true value, and we can measure it. And what would we like to be true about this expectation of our estimate, of our maximum likelihood estimate? So you bring me your equation, and you say, this is a really good equation, but the bias is 50, 100, 27. My response would be, so you could actually bring me a really great, what you think is a really great equation, but it could be worse than the equations a previous graduate student brought me, because the bias could be smaller. Or for your equations, it's possible that the bias would not go to zero as we increase the number of samples n. So it's not just, is there bias? All estimators have some amount of bias for a given value of n. The question is, if your equations are really good equations, the question is, how does your bias go to zero? Is it unbiased, right? Does your bias go to zero as n increases, and the rate at which your bias goes to zero? That's what's going to get you your PhD. The fact that your bias goes to zero faster, perhaps, and is unbiased than the previous technique. So, we'd like to explore the bias invariance to this estimate. And to do so, we need to know something about the means, the variances, and the covariance. So, in the pattern recognition course, we go through some extensive derivations of this. What I'll go through today is the estimate of the mean and a little bit about the estimate of the variance. So if the x sub i's are fixed, and our linear combinations of the y's, we can note that since the y's have a normal distribution, then the ML estimates of beta 0 and beta 1 also have normal distributions. Now, that statement is much more subtle than you might think. But let's remember that we have a linear model. Y is a linear function of x, which also means if you turn that model around, x is a linear function of y. And if the y's are Gaussian, we know that linear combinations of a Gaussianly distributed random variable is also Gaussian. So therefore, the betas and the x's will also have Gaussian statistics. And again, this is why Gaussian assumptions are so convenient. So now we're going to assume that the ML estimates, now not the variable itself, but the ML estimates of these variables is a Gaussian distributed random variable. The ML estimate itself can be thought of as a Gaussianly distributed random variable. So here we have the expression for our maximum likelihood estimate of beta 1, which we call beta 1 hat, and I just rewrote that just because we're going to make use of that now. So what we want to do is we want to take the expectation of beta 1 hat. Now, if your estimate is unbiased, you would hope that the expectation of beta 1 hat is equal to beta 1, which is the true value. So we'll show that in a moment. But I want to make sure that we understand why this is so important. For a given data set N, and the pattern recognition students, of course, have heard me preach about this all semester, but since I've got a new set of graduate students here, I want to make sure you understand this. Because the day comes when you go to defend your thesis, and you say, my algorithm is better than Joe's algorithm because I got 3% error and Joe got 4% error, what's the first thing I'm going to say? What?
Consistently.
Is your algorithm consistently better?
Yeah.
Why? That's a good answer. Why?
Because new data will come. Maybe your program will fail when the new data, you have new data sets.
Because there's always some chance. It's a random process, right? There's always some chance you got lucky and your experiment turned out better than Joe's experiment. Now Joe, of course, did everything right. He did lots of experiments and actually computed the expectation. But you weren't so lucky because you're a newer graduate student. You just did one experiment on one data set and you say, aha, I'm better.
Most of the papers just use one data set and they never try to.
Yeah, well, most papers don't have me as a reviewer. I can tell you when I review papers, and as do my colleagues, in my community, we're very particular about how you run experiments, and we look for this kind of a thing. In fact, we also talked in the pattern recognition course about statistical significance.
You just only build a huge database to store some kind of data. You still don't avoid new data time. I mean, as time changes.
So what did we talk about in pattern recognition then? We talked about some techniques to resample your data so that you could estimate this, right? So what you can do is you can take your data set and you can partition it, for example, 10 different ways. And you can do 10 experiments, 10 independent experiments on that same data. And then your error rate can be estimated as the average of those 10 experiments. Now, I'll tell you why graduate students don't do this. When you do that, some of the error rates you're going to get are going to be very bad. Because this is a sampling process. Some will be very good. More than likely, if you've made a good contribution, the average of those 10 will be reasonable, and it'll be better than Joe's algorithm. But unfortunately, the variance So you do these 10 experiments and you compute the expectation. That expectation is going to be pretty noisy because 10 experiments is a fairly small number. And in general, these error rates can go to zero as, or the variance goes to zero as the number of experiments increases. So then you have to fight that problem that you might want to repartition the data 100 times instead of 10 times. And oftentimes, the computational requirements for one experiment are so extreme, running 100 experiments is unthinkable, right? And that's why a lot of research papers don't often do this. Instead, what we do in my community and what I taught in the pattern recognition class is how you can estimate the statistical significance of your error rate. Unfortunately, for graduate students, and researchers in general, I like to pick on graduate students, but when you do that, you find out the expected variance of that estimate is very large, and therefore your result is not statistically different from Joe's result. You're seeing this in the election right now, and that's another thing I love to talk about, is that you look at the margin of errors, which is essentially the variance of these polls that they're computing, right? And right now they're saying, well, Obama's leading McCain
10%.
By what?
10%.
10% now, yeah. In fact, which I think is actually statistically significant for the polls. But a couple weeks ago, across the four or five states that were going to determine the election, they were trying to say that Obama was winning, but the amount he was ahead was like 3 or 4%, which was within the margin of error of the poll. So they couldn't quite, you know, you could see the announcer just dying to say we're projecting he's going to win, but they couldn't really say that because the margin of error was so high, because the sample sizes are so small. So that's another point that we'll sort of see here. So let's go ahead and compute the expectation of beta 1 hat. Well, this is going to be the expectation of this estimate, where we have 1 over n times the sum of xi minus x bar and so forth, just repeating what I wrote on the previous slide. Now, fortunately, we can do some simplifications here. The 1 over n is a constant, so we can pull that out. The expectation of this sum of random variables, well, we have for the denominator is essentially a constant, so we can also pull that out. And the only thing we have to really worry about is this expectation of the things with revolving x sub i's and y sub i's. So the expectation of this sum we can treat as the sum of the expectations because, and this is the key thing, we're assuming that the x's are fixed. So this xi minus x bar is constant with respect to the expectation. So the expectation of this sum of xi minus x bar is just the sum of the expectations, and therefore we can write this as xi minus x bar times the expectation of y sub I. That's a key simplification, because now for y sub I, we can substitute beta 0 plus beta 1 x sub I, and we can then, because, and this is another little sort of trick here, is that we showed that the expectation of y was just the expectation of f of x. So for the y's, we can substitute beta 0 plus beta 1 times x sub I. And therefore, we can write, splitting this now into the terms associated with beta 0 and the terms associated with beta 1, we can write beta 0 times the sum of xi minus x bar over this denominator term plus beta 1 over n times the same thing, except now we have this x sub I. So if we look at the term associated with beta 0, this numerator is essentially just the same as the denominator. So, the numerator term, we have x bars are a constant. So if we sum x bars, we just get n of them. X sub i's, if we sum x sub I, we also get x bar. So this numerator term is essentially zero. On the second term associated with beta 1, we have what amounts to xi times xi minus x bar. Now, the sum of xi times xi, that's just x bar squared. That's just the what we call the variance of x sub I, which is what we're denoting as this the expectation of x squared. This xi times x bar, well, x bar is a constant, so we can pull that outside the sum, and the sum of xi just gives us x bar. So that just gives us the quantity x bar squared, and we have n of those. So the net result of this is that the numerator term and the denominator terms are the same, and therefore they cancel, so we're just left with beta 1. So what we've shown here is that the expectation of beta 1 hat, that's our expectation of our maximum likelihood estimate, is equal to the true value beta 1. Now again, in a real application, you won't know what the true value of beta 1 is if it's an unknown data, if it's an unknown data set. But for simulated data sets, we can synthesize data with a known beta 1, and then we can run the maximum likelihood estimate, and we can actually show that the expectation will be equal to beta 1. Now, the only thing you have to worry about, if you actually want to show this experimentally, what you have to worry about is, do you have enough samples of your maximum likelihood estimate so that when you compute the expectation, you have enough data so that these two are sufficiently close? And that's the problem that we refer to as statistical significance. If you only have one estimate of your error rate or your parameter because you only have one data set, obviously you can't take the expectation. Obviously, to use that error or that value by itself is not really meaningful because you can't demonstrate that the expectation of that value is equal to the true value. So when you're developing a new algorithm, it's important to show that the expectation of your estimate of that parameter is equal to the true value. And that's what we call bias. And that's something that's typically done theoretically rather than experimentally. Okay, so that's, so good news, you're halfway home, you brought me this new algorithm. You've proven to me that your algorithm is unbiased. That's a good thing. What's the next question I want to ask? What? Consistent. And what does that mean?
I mean, the ones, when it equates the ones were approached to zero.
And, it'll approach to zero, and it should approach faster than Joe's algorithm, right? So, the variance of the ML estimate of beta 1 can be computed as follows. So we're going to take the variance of beta 1 hat, and that's going to be the variance of our estimate for beta 1 hat. And again, we can do a similar kind of thing. The variance of this, the sum, it can be the sum of the variance. The denominator term is constant, so we can write this as the sum of the variance of this term here. And that's just going to be, and again, it's a little bit tricky. The denominator term is a constant, so we don't have to worry about that. The numerator term is the product of two random variables, x and y. And the variance of that product can be factored into the variance of each one of them individually. So we'll write the variance of xi minus x bar times sigma squared, where sigma squared represents the variance of y, and we maintain the xi minus x bar. So we'll pull the constant, the denominator term out, and now we have the sum of xi minus x bar squared. Well, that's just our old friend, n times the expectation of x squared minus the square of the mean of x. So this term, the numerator term here, reduces to n times x squared bar minus x bar squared. We have that times sigma squared. And then if we go ahead and cancel similar things here, in the denominator we have we have just this sigma squared over n times x bar squared minus x squared. Because I also needed to mention here that we have the variance of this term, and the denominator term is a constant, but we're taking the variance, so we actually get a square of the denominator term over here. And that's why, therefore, this term divided by this term leaves us this term in the denominator. So the variance of beta 1 hat is just sigma squared over n times the quantity x squared bar minus x bar squared. Now, why is this relationship significant? We talked about this concept of consistency. Consistency means what? You said it earlier.
That's one approach to infinity.
Right, this is proportional to 1 over n, which is a good thing. The details of this actually aren't as important as the fact that it's proportional to 1 over n, which means as n becomes large, the variance goes to 0. So that's another very important property of these maximum likelihood estimates.
So the right side, the left side should be n squared between the denominator.
No, that's square. That is squared.
No, the
n is always going to be squared.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. You're right. Because this comes about from, we have the variance of this term, so we get the denominator squared over here. Right. So in a similar manner, we can show that the expectation of beta 0 hat is equal to beta 0. Not surprising, if beta 1, it's a linear function. If this all worked out nicely for beta 1, it should also work out for beta 0. And the variance of beta 0 has a slightly different form, but still has this proportionality to 1 over n. So as n becomes large, the variance of beta 0 goes to 0. And we can also talk about, this is kind of an interesting quantity, the covariance between our two parameter estimates.
Why do I need to compute those parameters? I mean, the covariance between beta 2 and beta 1.
Well, because the variance, in general, this describes the joint probability distribution between the two variables, of which everything else can be derived, the marginals and that. So this is sort of, if we're going to assume that beta 0 and beta 1 are jointly Gaussian, then we need to know the means and the covariances. So the covariance of beta 0, beta 1, can be shown to be equal to this term that I've written here. And the key thing here is there's two things. One, it's proportional to sigma squared. And then second, that it goes to zero as n goes to infinity. But yeah, we won't do anything with this today. But it's just another property of the ML estimates that's good to know. So, to make a long story short, well, we've spent about an hour showing that the LMS estimate and the ML estimate of the regression function are identical, unbiased, and consistent, and that's a good thing. And that's why, actually, mean squared error estimates are so powerful, because they're essentially maximum likelihood solutions for most of these problems. So, as I like to point out, you know, since high school, you've been taking a number of measurements, summing them up, and dividing by n, and calling that the mean. And now, you know, 8 years later or so, you can actually prove mathematically that that makes sense. Because that you didn't know it at the time, but you were doing a maximum likelihood estimate of the mean. So this is all I'll say now about regression. But what we'll do next class, I still want to talk about hidden Markov models today, but what we'll do next class is now we're going to postulate a linear function as our way to adapt our parameters, and we're going to estimate that linear function using regression techniques. And then we're going to show that the re-estimation equations for that linear function fit very nicely within the hidden Markov model framework, or really any framework in which you're using EM to estimate your parameters. So that the maximum likelihood linear regression approach becomes a nice application of EM to the problem of estimating this regression function. Now, we also, in a lot of applications, we actually also use this regression function to estimate derivatives. And this is another nice little application of statistics to signal processing. In applications like speech recognition, our feature sets actually consist of parameters plus derivatives of the parameters. And as you may know, there's many ways to estimate derivatives, but in general, estimating the derivative of a discrete time signal is a very noisy process. If you just difference adjacent samples of a signal, for example, you'll get a very bad estimate of the derivative. And it turns out this regression approach is a really good way to estimate derivatives. Because what is a derivative? A derivative is nothing more than the slope. So if you have feature vectors, you can use a regression analysis to estimate beta 1, and that gives you an estimate of the derivative. So that's another historically significant application of regression. Now, the next thing that I want to do, I want to spend a few minutes talking about hidden Markov models, because it's hard to decouple the MLLR approach from things that are integral to the formulation of hidden Markov models. However, I don't want to spend too much time repeating everything we know about hidden Markov models. Hopefully you've seen those either in a previous random processes course or some kind of signal processing course. My guess is a number of you haven't, and so I've included a few slides on hidden Markov models. I mainly want to give you a heads up on some quantities that are going to surface when we derive the actual MLLR equations. So let me say just sort of a couple things about hidden Markov models. If I give you a set of data that has some sort of temporal structure to it, like vectors that correspond to the way the speech spectrum evolves over time, or vectors that correspond to the way a image is evolving over time, we know in the case of signals like voice that there's some underlying structure in that signal that's important. Language is typically composed of words. Words are in terms composed of elementary sounds like phonemes. And one way we can model language, whether we're talking about text, where you have characters that build up to compose words, or whether we're talking about audio, where you have phonemes that build up to words, it's possible to model that signal as a state machine that's traversing between these underlying parameters. Now, why that's relevant to our MLLR problem? Well, if you remember, when we invoke the EM theorem, the estimation process includes the introduction of an intermediate variable. We called it T in the derivation last class. And this fits very nicely with problems like speech recognition, where we have underlying variables, phonemes, that we don't explicitly estimate, but we estimate them as part of the recognition process. Now, the same is true for images. With images, you can decompose images into any number of building blocks. Sometimes people use elementary shapes like squares and lines and circles and things. And other signals have the same kind of properties. This model is very, very popular right now in DNA sequencing, because DNA sequences you can also model as transitions between, there's sort of a language that they're using to encode DNA sequences. So what we want to postulate here is a model that has some hidden variables, which we will call states. And at each one of these states, each one of these states produces an observable symbol, which we will call V. And then, therefore, the model generates data by traversing between these states and outputting symbols at each one of those states. And any symbol that you observe has some probability of being output at any state. So when I talk about a data sequence, I don't know really what set of states actually produce that sequence, because any state could output any symbol. So if I say, for example, the word cat, which is a K followed by an A followed by a T, I don't know which of these states actually produced those particular phonemes. They could have been produced, each of those phonemes could have been produced at any state. That's the hidden aspect of the model. And therefore, one of the ways that we estimate the parameters of the model is to choose the state sequence that was most likely, or maximum likelihood state sequence. And that becomes part of the estimation process when we're trying to estimate the probability of an observed set of symbols. We have to do that by maximizing or finding the most likely state sequence that could have produced that set of symbols. So this is a process called hidden Markov modeling. It's a Markovian because the transitions, the model is defined in terms of a single transition from one state to the next. We don't worry about previous history. So it's a first order Markov model because this transition from one state to the next is only conditioned on the history accumulated at that point to that state plus that transition. It doesn't depend on previous transitions explicitly. So this model has a few key parameters associated with it. It has transition probabilities A, transition probabilities which represent, it's a matrix which represents the transition probabilities between states. It has an output probability distribution which describes at each state the probability that I could produce one of these V symbols. And then it has a initial state distribution probability, the probability that I started in any one of these states. And that it might be appropriate to make this probability equal to say, well, the probability of being in any state at time zero is the same. But it turns out even in applications like language, not all phonemes are equally probable to be the first phoneme in a word, for example. You can go into the dictionary and compute probabilities and you'll find out that certain phonemes are much more probable of being the first phoneme than others. So we can actually estimate these probabilities from the data as well. And it makes sense generally not to make these equal. Now, there's a number of key computations that we need to do in dealing with these models. And I don't want to, you know, go through the complete derivation of these things, but if you have a statistical model, let me go back to the previous page. I can never get that to work. If you have a model, as we're showing here in the upper right on slide number 5, once you've trained this model, a very reasonable question would be, can I compute the probability that I generated or observed a particular sequence given the model? And that's the problem that we call, that's the problem that we call decoding or evaluation. And that computation can be done using a trellis structure, and it can be shown to be an iterative computation involving some intermediate variables, which we will call alphas. And the way you compute that probability is essentially unfolding the state machine over time and then accumulating these partial probabilities as a function of time. And that's done using an iterative algorithm, which we call the forward algorithm. There's a similar algorithm called the backward algorithm, which simply involves computing probabilities backwards through the lattice. And it's just simply a time reversal of the computation. The second kind of general problem of importance is how you train the model. And training the model essentially involves taking some labeled data and finding the path through this model that was most likely to have produced the labeled training data, and then keeping track of how many times a data element was produced by a particular state, and then re-estimating the probabilities of those states by the number of transitions that occurred over the total number of transitions that could have occurred. Now, the proof of the derivation of this is rather complicated, but we talk about this in a when you go through like a course on Hin-Markov models, like the pattern recognition course. So the solution to this problem uses an algorithm known as the forward-backward algorithm, which again makes use of these intermediate variables we call alphas and betas. And it actually uses a estimate of the transitions through these models, which we call the gammas. So this gamma variable, this is an intermediate variable that's used to compute when you're training the model. It keeps gammas keep track, essentially, of how often that particular state and that particular output symbol at that state is being used. Now, the reason I wanted to introduce this is because we will see these gammas when we derive the maximum likelihood linear regression estimates. So we'll have a chance to see how we can use these same calculations for Hin-Markov models in the re-estimation process for the maximum likelihood transformation. Now, the other little twist that we do with this model, let me go back to the picture here. When Hin-Markov models were first introduced, they were first introduced in a context where at each state you had a discrete number of symbols that could be produced by the model. So for example, if we were modeling some of the very earliest applications of this, we're trying to model letters in written text. And if you think about that kind of a problem, in English there's 26 letters. So a very reasonable model. If you wanted to model spelling, for example, you would have at each state one of the 26 letters could be output. Or you might want to do lowercase and uppercase letters, so 52 letters. But many problems like that lend themselves to discrete alphabets at each one of these states. And even if your data is not discrete in nature, you can use a process called vector quantization to convert continuous value features to discrete value features. However, it was very, very early on when hidden Markov models were introduced, people realized that rather than have discrete distributions at each state, I could actually postulate a multivariate Gaussian distribution at each state, and I could estimate the parameters of that multivariate Gaussian distribution, namely the mean and the variance at those states, using the same techniques, the EM algorithm, maximum likelihood estimation, that I use for the parameters of the models, the transition probabilities, and the... So, what we actually do in these models is to postulate not just a single Gaussian, but we actually postulate a Gaussian mixture distribution at each state for the hidden Markov model. So you might have, it's not uncommon in state-of-the-art systems to have 128 Gaussian distributions associated with each state. Now, if you think about that from a parameter point of view, if you have a 39-dimensional feature vector, and you're going to have a single Gaussian is going to require a 39-dimensional mean vector, and a 39 by 39 covariance. And so that in itself is 1,600 parameters. And if you're going to allocate 128 of these per state, that's 1,600 times 128, which is like 100,000. And then if you're going to have many thousands of states, before you know it, you've got millions of parameters. And Gaussian mixture, hidden Markov models based on Gaussian mixture distributions are very, very popular across a wide range of applications. They're very, very powerful, but they use millions of parameters. And this is why we're studying adaptation, because if you have such a complicated model and you want to update that model based on a small amount of data, you can see the problem you have. You have a large number of parameters, a small amount of update data. You're going to have to do something intelligent to model the data. Well, what we're going to try to do is to essentially adapt the means of this model and then eventually the variance of this model. And we're going to try to do that using a linear transformation, using this maximum likelihood linear regression approach. So when we go through MLLR, we'll talk about mean adaptation and variance adaptation. And the reason for that is that the output distributions at each state are written in terms of means and variances. These are essentially the parameters that drive the hidden Markov model. So I think at this point I'll stop. There's a few more slides on how we actually apply the EM process to derive the re-estimation equations for the hidden Markov model. And this is a, you know, this is one of the more interesting pieces of technology that's been developed over the past 10 years, actually 10, 15 years. And what's nice about it is we do end up with re-estimation equations that write that allow you to re-estimate the means and variances of these continuous distributions, and that's done in terms of these intermediate likelihoods that we can actually relate back to the parameters of the hidden Markov model. So there's some very nice, relatively straightforward re-estimation equations that can be computed in a iterative way. And the reason we have to understand some of this is because these same intermediate variables will be used to compute the maximum likelihood linear regression transformations. So before next class, it would be useful for those of you who have not been exposed to this to go to follow the links to the pattern recognition notes and to read through some of the background on this. And that'll help, I think, better prepare you for the next lecture. So next time we're going to talk about maximum a priori adaptation and hopefully begin MLLR, and we'll talk about it in the context of this problem of re-estimating means and variances of these kinds of models. Okay, see you on Tuesday.